Hi, this is Rick Emerson, and the following encore of Legion of News is brought to you by Squires Electric. Whether it's electrical wiring, Ethernet wiring, or wiring of any kind at all in your home or business, Squires Electric can make your life easier. Find out more at squireselectric.com or call 503-252-1609. Squires Electric.
Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News!
High atop the Milkpacking District in the heart of beautiful Southeast Portland, Oregon. This, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all-important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson, alongside Mr. Big Jim Willig, who is filling in for Don Taylor today. Even as I speak these words to you, Jim Willig is preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, what headlines, Jim Willig?
We have a Portland cop getting a DUI after a Tillamook County chase. We also have the latest on the Memphis 3, not to mention Geek Watch, Monkey Watch, Penis Watch. Literally, we are a wash in the sea of news.
It's a cornucopia of offensive delights.
Sir. It is. Something for every possible orifice and sense to be offended in some make, manner, or form.
As always, my friends... have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual...
What?
Damn you. And all that implies. As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, pay heed, my friends and comrades, for this is Legion of News. Hello, Jim Willig.
Hello, Rick Emerson. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thank you for filling in today. Don Taylor will return on Monday, so we appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to step in today.
Well, I have so many very many things to do, very many clamorings for my time and my attention. So, yeah, you're welcome.
Well, thank you. It's
I just wanted to sound uppity.
Coming up later on this hour, you get your entertainment news. Also, Science on the March coming up at the bottom of the hour and next hour, the Rick Emerson radio program. Without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, here is Mr. Big Jim Willig.
Suspicious package turns out to be a beer cooler. In Newburgh, New York, what was initially thought to be a suspicious package in the upper parking lot next to the Newburgh City Police Station turned out to be just a cooler full of beer. A passerby called it to the attention of the nearby police officer. The fire department was called out. And there were no wires and no other suspicious items sticking out when officers lifted it. They heard glass clanking, that all-too-familiar sound of Miller time. When it was opened, it was found to be just contained a couple of bottles of beer. So
I think that's what we called it. It was filled with refuse and bits of crap.
We like to call that a liquid lunch, is what that is. So if you're having a rough day, you know, just grab a couple of bottles of... Do they still make Löwenbräu? Do you know that? Do you know if that's
I think
case?
They do. I think they make Löwenbräu at the same factory where they make Meisterbräu.
Ooh.
Meisterbräu, by the way, which is really the most ironically named beer, because no one who is a master of anything, life, their career, their own destiny, no one who drinks Meisterbräu is in fact control of or master of any part of their own existence. In just a moment, we'll have some additional news on the West Memphis 3, and we have some sound on that as well. Don't forget,
right.
You can get this program later on today if you'd like via iTunes. You can also get it as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or at LegionofNews.com. You can take it with you on the road as well. That is at mobile.cascadia.fm, mobile.cascadia.fm. Here is Mr. Big Jim Willig.
Jermaine Lewis attests, "I never resisted arrest." Former Baltimore Ravens wide receiver Jermaine Lewis, who was arrested at his Ryerstown home Monday in a reckless driving case, told TMZ that he was not resisting when police tased him. I guess this would be, a taser watch. Lewis said that he was sitting on his couch when officers used their taser in front of his crying 4-year-old son and barking dog. The report says, I never resisted arrest. Really, just if you've ever seen what Jermaine Lewis looks like, he kind of has just the air of a man that just says, don't F with me.
Really, I think that, you know, at a certain point, if you're sitting there and you're in the living room and the kid is crying, the dog is barking, the cops have got their taser out, you have to wonder exactly how many wrong left turns you took in your life to put yourself inside that scenario.
Yeah.
Really, you have to ask yourself, how many times did I get to the bottom of the page in my particular Choose Your Own Adventure novel, and then I chose poorly? Do me a favor, take the put a pin in that and the penis watch and the other watches, and we'll do those in the second in the second show. So we'll flag those, we'll set those aside for the Rick Emerson show. And
did you want to discuss the West Memphis 3?
If you've got that sound sheet in front of you, we'll move to that, and then we'll I like to just concentrate all of the horrifically offensive material into one sort of aesthetically displeasing audio bomb for next hour.
Sort of let that drop, and then the slow shock can wear off.
Exactly. Just sort of maximize the aural impact next hour. Here is Big Jim Willigan for Don Taylor.
When the three men convicted 18 years ago in the deaths of three boys in West Memphis, Arkansas, have been freed, the so-called West Memphis Three pleaded guilty in exchange for a sentence of time served.
And just to interrupt for just 1 second, I want to say that we were actually doing the Rick Emerson show yesterday when this news came out. It was like at about 2:15, 2:30, something like that. And because we've sort of been following this case on the Emerson show for however many years.
Yeah, that HBO documentary is years old.
96.
Yeah.
96 is when that first came out. And, you know, and Damian Echols in that time, it's like you saw him go from just being this, you know, sort of misfit, loner, outcast kid.
Kind of Cure fan-ish.
Yeah, into really becoming, I mean, it was weird and sad and strange and surreal to see those guys become 30-something men, you know, as time went on. So yesterday when the story came out, and it was one of those things that you never thought you would actually get a chance to say or report or witness, and Aaron Duran was the first person to send us a link to the breaking news story yesterday.
Yeah.
It said Damian Echols and others to be freed during West Memphis 3 case, and it was it's still kind of settling in for a lot of people, the idea that it actually is happening.
I remember when I saw that Innocence Lost documentary.
Paradise Lost.
Paradise Lost. Even then, this was like, I'd say, late 90s, so yeah, maybe just a few years after it came out. Even then, it seemed like one of those stories that you knew it never was going to actually, the justice was never going to get served, that this tiny town that, you know, I don't want to say it's backward or anything like that, but it really is the vibe that they're putting off. It was kind of heartbreaking to see that just because the times move a lot slower in that part of the country, that these kids were never going to see real justice served, and subsequently because someone needed to pay for these horrific crimes, that these were three going to be the ones that are going to basically have to fit that bill. But prosecutors agreed to the arrangement to avoid the possibility of a new trial. Prosecuting attorney Scott Engleton says only time will tell if this was the right decision.
Which cut is this?
This would be WM01.
The defendants have spent roughly half of their lives in prison, and I pray that they have been rehabilitated.
Damian Echols says that it's not a perfect deal because they still maintain their innocence. WM02.
Well, before we even move on to that, and this is the prosecuting attorney that we just heard from there, what kind of nonsense is that, the idea, I pray that they've been rehabilitated? Rehabilitated, which implies that there was something wrong with them in the first place. That there was some sort of, I mean,
this is such an obvious case of, we know if this thing goes to trial again, we are going to get pantsed woefully in front of the entire world. And, you know, these kids, obviously, there's nothing to hold them with. So we're just going to, if you guys say you did it, even though we all know you didn't, we'll let you kind of go about your day.
And I have such, I don't even get myself all cranked up about this right now, because there's a lot to get to in this hour. But I will say that my feelings about this are just so complicated. I was talking to my wife about this last night.
Yeah.
And she said, you know, because last night there were just leaks that were coming out, and there were sort of little reports about the story, but nobody really had the entire, nobody had seen the entire, you know, sort of ball of wax yet. And And she said, is it true that they're going to have to plead guilty to this, even though they say they didn't do it? Everybody believes they didn't do it. Most people believe they didn't do it. You know, it isn't that horrible. And I suppose it is. On the other hand, it's like, A, I guess if you're sitting in prison for 18 years, you know, and somebody says, look, just say this and you'll get out. I mean, that is probably pretty tempting. Also, I think it's one of those things where everybody knows the deal. Everybody understands exactly what's being done here and what's being said here. That's the only silver lining,
yeah,
is that even though they are, by the conditions of this agreement, they are forced to admit to something that they probably did not do.
Yeah.
Even though they're forced to do that, everybody knows that the state doesn't let you out of prison for admitting you did something. You know, that's not the way the justice system works. You don't go, hey, and I killed a guy, and the state goes, that's great, we're going to let you out. I mean, that is really the only upside you can say to this, is that it's so transparently just a way for the state to, as they say, save face.
Yeah, and that's really all this situation is.
Yeah,
and you know, the families who obviously are still emotionally charged by this whole thing, because granted, the defendants have spent half their lives in jail. The other, you know, the other three kids that were the victims, they never had a life to kind of, you know, to blossom or grow at all.
Well, and it's been 20 years where nobody's, yeah, been looking for, you know, whoever it is that actually perpetrated, yeah, the crime, because they found their, you know, because they found their alleged, the alleged perpetrators early on.
Yeah. This is a tearing open of that old wound and then like a slapping in the face with a Band-Aid to the families of the victims. And they thought that, you know, they had their good night's sleep assured for the rest of their lives. The guilty parties were in prison. All was right in the world. God was in his heaven. And now it's like, well, that's not necessarily the case.
So this is, what is the second cut here?
WMO2.
At least it brings...
Oh, and this is Damian Eccles, right?
Saying that it's not a perfect deal.
At least it brings closure to some areas and some aspects. You know, we can still bring up new evidence. We can still continue the investigations we've been doing. We can still try to clear our names. The only difference is now we can do it from the outside instead of having to sit in prison and do it.
And so I guess it's a really complicated deal, because I guess the deal is that they pled guilty to third-degree murder, or it was a third-degree plea, which means they weren't allowed to claim their innocence. They were allowed to acknowledge that they were found guilty, and that they had to acknowledge that there was enough evidence, I mean, by definition, that there was enough evidence to have found them guilty the first time around, but they are allowed to work to prove their innocence post-release.
Yeah, in exchange for their time served.
Yeah, which, you know, is not the best way to get out, but is somebody said this on Facebook last night, because I put this link up, and there was this whole discussion about, you know, what a miscarriage of justice it is that they have to, you know, plead guilty to get out, which, and I don't disagree with that, but by the same token, somebody kind of boiled it down to the best way that I, you know, that I could have ever seen it put. Somebody said, the most important thing is basically getting out of the state's gun sights.
Yeah.
You know, that's like, that's job number one. Like, when the state has you on death row, and when the state is getting ready to kill you, you know, you don't worry about the mechanism by which you are being freed. The first thing is just to get out, yeah, of there, out of the crosshairs. And then once that's done, you can worry about, you know, the niceties of it afterward, which, you know, unfortunately, they were put in that position.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling to try and figure out that, you know, like you said, when put in that situation, I would throw myself under, I don't know how many buses it would take just to get out of my current situation, and I'll deal with the repercussions later. Couple that with the fact that they're on like 10 years probation, that if they screw up so much as like as a hair, they're back in jail for another 21 years. Like that's it. Plus, the entire town, they're already villains. They're already monsters in their eyes, and there's nothing that they can do. Even if they brought the actual killers to justice, it would make no difference in their eyes.
It's funny because, yeah, no, I gotta try to keep it together, as they say, Bowfinger style. I'm just going to get myself all worked up about this. But, yeah, I really do have... I think there's a lot to say about this, and I have so many sort of mutually exclusive and interconflicting thoughts about this. We have one more cut, I think, on that sheet.
Yes, fellow defendant James Baldwin says he doesn't consider this justice and still maintains his innocence.
And in the beginning, we told nothing but the truth that we were innocent, and they sent us to prison for the rest of our lives for it. And then we had to come here, and the only thing that the state would do for us was to say, hey, we'll let you go, only if you admit guilt.
I mean, and our friend Seamus, who has been following this case for a long time as well, he said, being forced to plead guilty to save your own life is a sickening miscarriage of justice and an abuse of power. And then he noted that You know, imagine being released into a world where an endless sea of ignorant effing idiots are convinced that you are a child murderer.
Yeah.
Because that's because there were always, I mean, this all physical evidence, or should I say lack of physical evidence to the contrary, there is this massive section of people that are just convinced that they did it, largely because the justice system said they did it, and of course the government is never wrong.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's really what is at the root of this entire thing, the idea that the government didn't want to go back to trial, but the government also knew that they had a certain amount of leverage because these guys are sick of being in jail for 20 years, and Damian Eccles is on death row, and the state's getting ready to kill him. And so this allows the state to never, ever, ever have to say we're wrong or we're sorry, which, of course, are two things that authority figures are pathologically incapable of doing.
Yeah.
Admitting guilt or admitting remorse, ever. Doesn't matter. Teachers, preachers, cops, doesn't matter. In no way can authority institutions ever acknowledge that they made a mistake and that you were unfairly punished for something. So this gets them out from underneath that.
Well, and it only serves, I mean, this is no surprise, but it doesn't serve any purpose except to show just how flawed the system is and the fact that it can never sort of, I mean, if it did, that would at least resolve a little bit of its bad image in my eyes, or at least in a few people's eyes, I think. Because this is something that is so clear, so glaringly obvious, the case. But the fact that we can't even broach it, we can't even, you know, think of it for a millisecond. We're just going to throw this bone out there. We're going to release Barabbas, and that's going to be good enough. And, you know, not to liken it to that, but still, we're going to throw out this tiny little amount, and that's going to be enough to wash our hands completely clean.
We'll do, let's see, is that the end of that sheet
that was,
of sound?
That's all the sound bites I have.
Let's actually do the other two if you've, let's see, do you have, did I give you additional sound on this?
Yes, on this?
I think we've got one more. Do we have one that's called West Memphis 04? If not, we can hold that till next hour.
We don't, we're going to hold
okay,
that
okay, we'll do that next hour.
Okay.
I will say this, a couple other comments here. Let's see, this says, God damn, you should have nightmares about being wrongly accused in this country because the system will F you, and so will your ignorant, quote, peers in the jury. My wife, I guess like maybe a year, year and a half ago, was on a jury for what we'll call a capital offense.
Okay.
And I, because I don't want to give the specifics of the case, but she was on a jury for a case where a...
But it rhymes with C.B. Cooper.
Yes. Exactly. And I mean, and she came away from that just petrified of the legal system because she said that the jury was comprised of just such a bunch of genetic defectives. She said that she has never seen stupidity in a greater concentration than the other people that were on the jury with her. I mean, every single day.
And these were selected by our process.
Seriously.
Like,
this is like
won a lottery.
The voir dire process went through and went, you are the best 12 people we can possibly find. And there was actually a woman on the jury who said that her stated goal was to try to drag the thing out as long as possible because she liked getting lunch. Where the state was just, you know, because the state was like, well, and here's your $5 a day and a sandwich. And the sandwich was like, that was what put this woman over the top. And so her whole avowed purpose became to drag the trial out as long as possible because she wanted to get literally now, not figuratively, as many literal free lunches as possible from the man.
Because I was just going to blow that $5 on sandwiches anyway. And
yeah.
They go ahead and they hedged the bet. With free sandwiches.
And yeah, and so she would just come home every day, and it's like, and you know, and she was told not to talk about the case, and she didn't. She was actually very good about coming home and not discussing any of the details of the case or talking about her jurors until the whole thing was over. But I will tell you, what she did do every day was come home and drink. She got off work, and she would come home, and she would go right for the freezer. And like, out would come the bottle, in would go the alcohol, down would go the liquid, you know, up would come the glow.
Yeah, and you would, like, part of you would be like, let's ask her about her day, and then that one finger just came over and like, no, let's
I think on the second day she was on jury duty, I said, how's it going? And she just looked at me and she went, don't. She's like, don't even ask.
And like, what kind of a minefield does that put you in wearing swim fins, trying to maneuver around in that situation where you're like, you want to be supportive, but at the same time you realize that there's nothing that you can do?
At one point, let's see if I can say this. At one point, there was a guy. The guy who was on trial was convicted of doing something fairly heinous.
Okay.
Which, for what it's worth, and I should say that he was acquitted. For what it's worth, my wife sitting there hearing the evidence, hearing everybody testify, absolutely believed to her core that he was guilty. And you know, so I, you know, whatever. People said he got to go. Then I guess he got to go. But But one of the most persuasive pieces of quote evidence for his innocence was the fact that his grandfather testified and said that he didn't believe his grandson was a bad person, and in no way did he believe his grandson was capable of that kind of an act. Well, and a guy in the jury room said, "Well, you don't lie to your grandfather, and your grandfather doesn't lie about you, and that's good enough for me."
Well, that's the whole basis upon which Werther's Originals is based. Yeah. I mean, you can't argue with that kind of candy.
I think, and she said that like the guy, like he literally said something to the effect of like, "Well, my decision is made," and that was like on the second day of the trial or something, and it was, you know,
he says with whittling knife and stick in hand.
It's like he just came out of a Pepperidge Farm commercial, right into the jury room. It was like he'd seen it in the Magna Carta or something, you know, that like if thou's grandfather shall say that thou is innocent, then you know the trial shall be over at that point.
Thine soul be clean and thy way be righteous.
God damn.
Wow.
Anyway. So there you go. So we'll talk more about the West Memphis Three next hour. But yes. My little final parting observation here is something that my wife said following that trial, and something that, and we've had a few people make comments to this effect in the text box this morning, that every lawyer I have ever known in my life, everybody I have ever come into contact with who works in the justice system has said the same thing, which is if you have any option, never, ever, ever pick a jury trial, ever. Always demand that you get a bench trial where it's the judge who makes the decision and not the jury. Because here's the thing. As George Carlin once said, you think about how dumb the average American is and then realize half the country is dumber than that.
Yeah.
Those are not the people you want sitting in a box deciding your fate.
Yeah, and it's hard to wrap your head around how many people walk around this country blindly waving this fistful of rights and laws that they think are the way things are going to be, and if, you know, for whatever reason, they end up in a court of law, that they're going to be the same laws are going to get them out of this trouble. They are in for a rude awakening on biblical proportions.
Well, I mean, and the other thing is, and see, now we're not moving on again, but think about how much effort it took. I mean, as half of a loaf as this solution is, the idea that they're out of prison, so that's good. They're off death row. I mean, Damien Eccles is off death row. That's great. On the other hand, had to plead guilty to something that, in the opinion of most observers, they did not do, a crime committed by somebody else. Even as half-assed as this solution is, and as imperfect and as flawed as it is, think about how many years it took and how many people it took and how many thousands, probably tens of thousands of man hours it took to get to this point.
Yeah.
I mean, think of how many celebrities had to come out and rally for this, and how much money had to be raised, and how many fundraisers and benefits. And there have been 2 feature-length documentaries made about them. There's been a full-length book written about them, a book called Devil's Knot, which I strongly recommend to anybody who wants to know the details of the case. There's actually a third installment of that Paradise Lost series that is being filmed right now. And in fact, it's turned out the filmmakers were in court this morning filming the release because they have to go back and re-edit the ending of the third installment of the film because the guys have been released.
Was it the same guys that did Some Kind of Monster that did the last installment?
Yeah, it's Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sanofsky. They made Paradise Lost, Paradise Lost 2, and then Some Kind of Monster, the Metallica documentary, was the thing for which they became most famous. And they were actually working on a third Paradise Lost film. It was called Paradise Lost Purgatory, about the fact that the kids have been in jail for 20 years.
Yeah.
And they were there this morning filming the release because they're going to go back and put a new ending on the documentary. And apparently, they're going to do some marathon of the films on HBO.
Yeah. Talk about coming home and drinking, man. Those guys must just, oof.
Jesus.
Maybe that was their cooler of beer that was found in New York. Who knows? Let's move on, shall we?
Thank you, Jim Willing.
No problem.
Forcibly getting the train off this particular track. Otherwise, I'm just going to sit and just work myself into an embittered froth.
Well, this year's story is something that I think would be relevant to you. There's a weekend air show coming up, and it prompts pet warnings. Pet owners in Portland metropolitan area will want to take extra precautions this week as the Oregon air show gets underway. Workers at local animal shelters say that they are concerned about the loud noises from the jets will frighten animals and cause them to run away from their homes. It's the second busiest week of the year for us. Only the 4th of July brings in more animals to the shelter, Deborah Wood, manager of animal services for Washington County, said. Wood suggests that pet owners take several precautions to avoid any trouble, including making sure your pet has identification. Every pet should have collar tags and a microchip. What else is this? Does your dogs have low jack on them?
They do, actually. It's it's the weirdest thing. It's like I thought it was like a little tracking device, which I don't think they actually have that yet. But it's a thing that they inject under the skin, and so if somebody takes them to if somebody finds them and takes them to a vet or to a pound or a shelter that is so equipped or a target, they get scanned underneath the on the supermarket scanner, and it just comes up, you know, Emerson, Rick. Which is actually kind of great.
Nice.
Because that's, you know, that way if they get their, because our dog Philo, who is just such a coward. I mean, he's just.
Yeah, that's what sort of popped into my mind when this whole thing came. If a moving leaf is enough to send it into a terrifying.
Damn. He did that the other day. He literally, this is the second time he's done this. I got to try to capture it on film at some point because it's just so ludicrous. And it was like a study in contrast. It was because I've talked about this before. We get the two dogs. One is real big and one's real small. And the real small one, of course, has an overdeveloped sense of self, and was trying to force his way through our front gate. I mean, and he basically is just—he looks like a tribble. He looks like a tribble with little black, hateful eyes. And he was
like a doze.
I mean, he's just miniature and fluffy and harmless and ridiculous. And he was trying to force his way through the front gate to pick a fight with a Rottweiler that was walking. It's literally a Rottweiler because we have a neighbor down the street who owns one walking. And the Rottweiler not bothering anybody, not picking fights with anybody. And there's Max just trying to force his way through between the narrow slats of the fence so he can get out and show the Rottweiler, you know, what's what. And so I'm out there apologizing to the owner of the Rottweiler. I'm sorry, he's very excitable. It's Napoleon syndrome, you know, and I'm pulling him back. And then I look over and there's something like a flash of movement in the corner of my eye. And for the second time in just the year and a half we've owned him, I see Philo running away from a housefly.
just like a
fly buzzing around, you know, because the fly had, they had both moved at the same time. The fly had misnavigated. Philo had turned. The fly had adjusted position, and the fly had sort of gone sort of into his face. And so then Philo backed up, and the fly is, of course, confused because it ran into a big wall of fur. And so then the fly is sort of disoriented and decides to try to go the other way. And so at that point, Philo's just had enough, and he just literally turns tail and runs into the corner of the front porch and just sort of cowers there staring at the fly. It's like a study in contrast.
Well, pet owners who live within earshot of the planes should also take their pets inside. She also recommends creating an indoor sanctuary for your pets if possible. Some white noise from a radio or TV can be very helpful in drowning out the noises. Also, maybe fly strips would be good, and butterfly nets, should your animal be so inclined.
Oh, and so that was my thing about the chip, is the reason we have the chip in Philo, A, is just because it's a good idea in general, but also because we had to switch to a leather collar for him, because when we had a plastic, you know, there's this collar, collars where it's like the, you know, it's like a seatbelt buckle on a plane where one end of the plastic collar snaps into the other.
Mm-hmm.
He actually would get so terrified when we first had him. He would strain against his collar so hard that he would snap the collar trying to run away from, you know, a baby. Or just the sun, or just whatever it was that was wind, whatever it was that was frightening him.
Change your barometer pressure.
Yeah, a solar flare, and he would immediately just be like, that's it, I'm out of here. And he would actually strain so hard that he started to crack the collar. So we had to switch to a leather collar for him. But
that's crazy.
We actually got him a big bottle of those. It sounds ridiculous, but we got him a big bottle of those so-called doggy downers, like the dog Valium.
All right.
You know, and that worked moderately well, but it's like you can't be. But then it's like you got it. But then you got it like some Judy Garland dog that's up late at night, just drinking out of a bottle of vodka and singing over the phone to relatives. You don't want that.
Usually Christmas carols, if memory serves. Should we move on to science?
Let's move on to science. Ladies and gentlemen, here is your Science on the March for, what is today, Friday?
It is Friday all day.
Thank God almighty. Here's your Science on the March for Friday, brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find out more about them at squireselectric.com or facebook.com/squireselectric. You can also call them at 503-252-1609, 503-252-1609. They are licensed, bonded, and insured electrical installers, contractors, and supervisors. If it has to do with wires or wiring in your home or business, they can make your life easier. They are Squires Electric at squireselectric.com. They are the proud sponsors of this, your Science on the March.
Science states critters moving away from from global warming even faster. Animals across the world are fleeing global warming by heading north much faster than they were less than a decade ago, a new study says. About 2,000 species examined are moving away from the equator at an average rate of more than 15 feet per day. about a mile every year, according to a new research published Thursday in the Journal of Science, which analyzed previous studies.
Wait, so they're moving where?
They're moving north, away from the heat of the equator.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Species are also moving up mountains to escape the heat, but more slowly, averaging only about 4 feet per year. The species, mostly from the northern hemisphere, and including plants, believe it or not, moved in fits and starts, but over several decades, it averages more than 8 inches an hour away from the equator. The speed is an important issue, the study main author Chris Thomas says from the University of New York. It's faster than we thought. Federal weather data show the last decade was the hottest on record, and 2010 tied with 2005 for the hottest day on record.
I don't understand how they're moving an average of 4 feet. 4 feet is just like over there. What do you mean they're moving 4 feet a year?
Okay, do you remember a very informative film by the name of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids? Do you remember how long it took them to cross the yard?
Okay, no, that's
with,
it.
With the assistance of ants and oatmeal cookies?
Okay, I guess I'm thinking about me, not like, you know,
yeah.
not aphids.
Yeah, and maybe you should take a lesson from the aphids.
It doesn't mean anything.
Maybe you should head north as well. Young man.
Okay.
Away from the...
Yeah. If only I knew what way that was.
I hate knowledge. All right, moving on.
Here's a weird thing.
Yeah.
You know, my iPhone has got a compass in it. You know, and it's like you just go to the compass mode and it looks, you know, it looks like the old school, like, Boy Scout compass or whatever. I know there's probably an answer for this, but, I mean, I don't understand how that works. I mean, like, in your actual compass, there's a real piece of metal that really homes in on the magnetism of the North Pole, right?
Yeah, yes.
But it's not like your iPhone is full of magnets. Not that anyone even knows how, you know, how.
Well, there's magnets used in them.
Like it's a GP. You're just making that.
Well, no. I got my girlfriend a Kindle for her birthday, and she discovered that if she lays it on, and it has like internet capabilities, so it has a lot of the same components as an iPhone or any handheld kind of device of that nature. But she laid it on some metal paper clips and picked them up and found out that the magnet is actually very strong enough to hold these paper clips to her Kindle.
Well, see, now somebody has said, and I guess I could have figured this out myself given several years in a dark room where I didn't have to do anything else but think.
Slowly moving north.
Somebody says, what's your GPS? And then they imply, idiot. Except, which
very
I get.
Sarcastic font.
Here's the, well, it's implied. The thing about the GPS is, like, the GPS makes sense to me in a macro sense, but not in a micro sense. And by that, what I mean is this. I can somehow get that the GPS can track your movement, like, where you are, because it, you know, it triangulates. You know, in other words, I get that the GPS can track that you are here and you're moving, you know, you're moving down the street and it's sort of following you as, like, a dot on the thing. What weirds me out is the idea that if you're just setting your cell phone on the table, the cell phone knows which way it's pointed. That's the thing that for some reason seems to elude me. The idea that the cell, because that is the cell phone being able to tell its own orientation in space as opposed to its own place on the ground, if that makes sense.
Well, yeah.
That's the thing that kind of freaks me out.
Well, I would assume that basically on the original cell phones that had the pull-out antenna, that your average cell phone has like just an internalized version of that that's just a lot more strong, so you don't have to actually pull out the stem. But ideally, the same component is there, thus giving it a place on the grid.
See, this is the sort of thing that people say to screw with me because they know that I don't know if it's true or not. They say, it says, your iPhone has a gyroscope. See, now, is that true? Or is that somebody just effing with me?
I think that's they're effing with you because the gyroscopes that I'm familiar with come with a string. That you,
that's exactly
that you
what
pull
I was thinking. And then it sort of spins for a while on the table and you go, Ma, come look at this.
Well, I mean, that's why you're only paying $40 a month from Cricket to get unlimited text. And
there's a guy back at the Cricket office who's having to, like, pull that string all the time. Just keep the gyroscope going.
Here's the thing. The string is domestic, but your gyroscope's foreign, so it's going to take me another couple of weeks before I get that part in for you.
All right.
Speaking of Bill Pullman, aliens may destroy humanity to protect other civilizations, say scientists. It may not rank as the most compelling reason to curb greenhouse gases, but reducing our emissions might just save humanity from a preemptive alien attack, scientists claim. Watching from afar, extraterrestrial beings might view changes in Earth's atmosphere as symptomatic of a civilization growing out of control and take drastic action to keep us from becoming a more serious threat, the researchers explain. This highly speculative scenario is one of several described by a NASA-affiliated scientist and colleagues at Pennsylvania State... Pennsylvania State University that, while considered unlikely, they say could play out were humans and alien life to make contact at some point in the future. That'll be the reason why they come to Earth.
Sure.
Is because we're squandering all the usable water
right.
and air.
Of course.
Yeah.
Now people are just sending me... Okay, listen, can I just tell you this? Here's what I've got so far. We've got, Rick, your iPhone has a, magnetometer in it, says Michael.
Magnetometer?
I don't even know if that's a thing that really exists. It's magnetometer.
Magnet?
Essentially what the word is.
Closer.
And then he says, it also has an accelerometer. See an accelerometer? No. Here's the thing. This is like when Jen Lane would talk about her fuel tank in the car, and she would refer to it as her gasometer, and she'd say, "I'm sorry, my gasometer's broken. I didn't realize that I didn't have enough gas to get to your house or something." And it's like, because that's what her brain told her that thing ought to be called. That's like accelerometer. All right. I'm sorry.
All right. Well, along the lines of Skynet, robot planes get their own airport in Wales. The unmanned drone, Watchkeeper WK450, will use the runway for test flights. Click to enlarge this image. The world's first airport for unmanned aircraft is opening in rural Wales, and officials say it could be the first step in getting human and robot-piloted craft together in the same airspace. The United Kingdom's Civilian Aviation Authority has just granted permission for both the West Wales Airport and Aberporth, and a 500-square-mile airspace to be dedicated to unmanned aircraft. So, yeah, there's that.
So there's that. That
there,
happened.
There's this.
I feel so unqualified to weigh in on any story now, even if it's just to go, uh-huh, really, you don't say, and I'm so confused.
These are other emotions we will not allow during this science segment.
So he says, imagine being accused of any crime involving technology in a world where the average idiot doesn't know how to turn their computer on, or, you know, how their phone works. Thank you, sir. Let's do one more here, and then we will move on to something less sciencey and daunting.
Alrighty. Giant lobster on exhibit in Coney Island. An 18-pound American lobster was found a safe home in New York Aquarium in Coney Island. Coney Island, long known for its circus-like sideshows and carnival atmosphere, just gained a new freak. An 18-pound lobster that experts say could be as much as 75 years old and so delicious. The massive beast was caught off the coast of Canada and sent to the New England Lobster Co. in San Francisco.
Do you suppose that if you're trying to transport an 18-pound lobster through New England, that there's just like highwaymen the entire way that are just trying to, you know, just trying to get you over to the side of the road and just hijack the cargo and take it with them?
Just guys with harpoons the entire way.
Seriously. I mean, it's like, you must be able to hear just like the drooling, slavering hunger of the entire region as you are. You must have to get like a squadron of like, you know, like the 82nd Airborne or something to accompany that lobster to the museum so that it's not just jacked on the way.
I would see it more as the longshoremen to be more worshipful of the beast.
It's their new god.
Yeah, to be like, if you remove this one from the sea, then all lobsters will sort of like, you know, fall off, and there'll be no more lobstering for anyone. So it needs to be released back into its culture so that it may continue to reign over all lobster kind.
You know, lobsters are one of those things that it's like, I don't have any problem with eating animals or whatever. And it's a
giant insect.
Yeah, but that's my thing. That's my thing about eating a lobster. And I have this problem so much with crab. I don't, you know, they're kind of weird. Like, I don't want one scuttling around on my table or something. But I mean, the thing with lobster is somewhere between crab and lobster, there's some difference between them that one seems a lot like just a big sea insect, and the other one is like basically just a cockroach that lives underwater, and the other one is The other one is weird looking, but not quite as off-putting to me. Like, crab are sort of strange, but I can eat that. The thing about a lobster is, if I think about it too much, I can't eat lobster. Because then I start realizing that I'm basically just eating a thing that you find behind the refrigerator, you know, or like in your garden under a rock, except it happened to live in the ocean.
Well, see, for me, it's the other way. I think that crab are more the insect, because you have to work a lot harder to get anything, like, actually edible out of a crab.
Yeah. I mean,
there's a lot of compartments, but, you know, some of it's okay to eat, some of it's really not okay to try and consume. Whereas with lobster, you pretty much the bulk of it is good to go. I gauge its level of insect on how much of it you can actually eat.
You know, a crab is basically like...
Like a cat or a dog of the sea.
A crab is basically like a nautical version of one of those rooms from one of those houses from the Saw movies, where it's like, you know, certain areas are okay, certain areas you want to stay away from, but there's really no way to tell unless you go in. You know, some of it's fine, some of it gonna give you, some of it's just gonna leave you dead and liquefied, but you never really know until you try. All right.
So yeah, giant lobster on exhibit at the Coney Island Aquarium. If you want to go check out this giant sea roach. So, yeah. And that is all we have.
There we go. There's your Science in the March, brought to you by Squires Electric. You can find them at squireselectric.com or facebook.com/squiresElectric. And you can also call if you like. It's 503-252-1609. By the way, don't forget to join us next hour on the Rick Emerson radio program. That's at rickemersonshow.com. Coming up next hour, we have a Taser Watch, Penis Watch, also a Monkey Watch, I believe.
That's correct.
And we'll have another installment of Humor Me Comedy 101 today, talking about who, Mr. Big Jim Willie?
That'd be the life and legacy of one Louis C.K.
So that's coming up next hour at rickemersonshow.com, where you can be amused and entertained for the low, low cost of just 32 cents per day. That is at rickemersonshow.com. There you go. Here is Mr. Big Jim Willig filling in for Don Taylor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Emerson. The Sims are coming to Facebook, finally. Developers say that The Sims Social takes the classical life simulation game and transforms it into a social experience that allows players to interact in ways they could never do before in The Sims franchise. John Beckham, Vice President of Marketing at EA Games, said PC gamers could always share elements of the game with their friends, but could never actually play with their friends. For a community that is as social as The Sims is, to be able to now let them play The Sims on the number one social platform in Facebook, well, it's just a perfect marriage.
There was a tiny, tiny shred of productivity left in the human race, and
gone.
We were looking for a way to get rid of it, to vanquish it, yes. And so now, now we have accomplished that goal. We can actually waste exponentially more time.
I never was able to get into games like The Sims or like Civilization or anything like that, where, like, okay, if you need me against an unending horde of the undead to wield either a battle axe or a machine gun or something along those lines, I'm your guy. If you need me to accurately live out an imaginary creature so that it can, you know, bathe itself, feed itself, pay its bills, I'm working in the real world trying to keep all those plates spinning. I don't need a video game to simulate that for me.
Somebody, I think my wife made this observation too, but somebody wrote an article about the thing about most people, there is some sort of a bell curve for being into The Sims.
Yeah.
And it reaches its zenith. You know, you're right at the center of your Sims playing life when you yourself have no job.
Yeah.
Have no job and really no prospect of a job on the horizon, because then it just becomes... And they were making the argument that at least it kept you in a sort of employed frame of mind, that you were having to multitask, you were having to spin, you know, a lot of plates at once, having to keep, keep things together personally and professionally on a sort of a microcosmic level. But as soon as my wife got, like, an actual job, because there was this, like, 3-month period where she... I think she was getting ready to go to school, and so she had wrapped up the job she was at, but there was, like, I don't know, like 9 weeks or something before school started, and so she just was sort of had this slack time. Played The Sims a lot. The instant she started, like, going to school and getting a real job, though, she came home and she's like, F that, and was immediately done with the entire thing. As you said, it is just a replication.
Yeah.
But I think there is a real male-female dynamic at work here, too, because most of the really hardcore Sims players I know are women. Not all, but most. And the thing is, I think they started back in the 1980s. This is a thing they discovered then, because in the 80s, you started to see video game arcades transform into redemption centers. where it wasn't like you were going in and just playing, you know, you weren't just going in and playing Narc, you know, or something. You weren't just...
Yeah, bad dudes.
I can reference stuff that's old. I can talk about things that that are from then.
Tempest.
Track and Field.
Ooh, Burger Time. Balls in your court, Emerson.
Zaxxon.
Ooh, Pitfall.
What rules are we playing by here? What is it?
Calvin Ball, I believe, officially. The live-action version is finally here.
These are the 43-man Squamish rules that, anyway, but I remember in the late 80s, it started to transition to where, you know, the guys would go in to play video games, but then girls would go in and they would play these games that then in return gave you tickets that you would then go redeem for something that was like, you know, worth 3.5 cents or whatever. And so you were, in effect, paying to work so you could buy stuff. And it was this weird...
That's genius.
No, it, you know, and it's this weird, like, indoctrination into the consumerist culture. And I don't mean to be overthinking it, but it is a weird thing where it's training you to work so you can earn stuff, so you can buy stuff. And that really is what a lot of sim-type games are as well. It's you are working to be paid in virtual money so that you can buy virtual goods. And it really does, in some ways, train you to be a perfect American. It trains you to be a perfect capitalist.
Well, there's some new, I don't know if it's the next installment of WoW or if there's another game that's going to be multi-online player based. But the only way you can purchase goods and level up is by actually spending real money to purchase the thing. There's no more gold mining. You can't basically just set some inmates in some Chinese prison somewhere to work for you.
What?
So yeah,
damn
well,
it.
I know. Well, I mean, you can if you want to stay with, like, you know, yesterday's news. But if you want to stay with the new hotness, you're going to have to be shelling out even more money. I think the fact that, and I would say you're right, though, that a lot of women do tend to gravitate more towards The Sims. It might be a maternal instinct. I'm not sure what. But I know that when I lived in a house with multiple roommates, there was one situation where one of them was just a rabid, rabid Sims fan and tried to incorporate all the other roommates into playing it as well. And I gave it a shot, you know, because I was mostly unemployed. I was working like 2 days a week as a bouncer at a gay club. So I was like, you know, I got nothing but free time. Let me give this a shot. So I started started playing it. And of course, immediately you have to go so deep into creating these characters in their houses and their lives. So I basically just created a family of the Chicken Effers. And there was Hitler Chicken Effer, and there was Madonna Chicken Effer, and I think they had like a kid Chicken Effer. And they were, I tried to get them as naked as I possibly could, so they would just wander around, and like they would just run amok. And I remember she didn't talk to me for the better part of a week, because basically they were all in the same town or whatever. So like there would be like these moments where she's sitting there playing, all of a sudden bang, bang, bang at the door, and there's Hitler Chicken Effer like just like going crazy because he hasn't eaten in a couple days, because I haven't really cared that much to try and keep
so
him
your
alive.
Sim started bothering her.
Yeah, tried to like just knocking on doors and everything. It was just a bad state of affairs.
This is like those grubby kids from down the street that are always coming by my place, you know, and saying I only have half the bail money. If you could just help me out a little bit, and I'm fine. Somebody, I mean Seamus, says, don't you dare lump civilization in with The Sims, Jim. Don't you dare. One is a hardcore intellectual strategy game for grown men. The other is a Barbie simulator for middle-aged women, he says.
Seamus, I do apologize. And you are absolutely correct. I was just merely saying that with both of those types of games, I am of no good to anyone.
Yeah.
You know, so.
No, it's.
Yeah.
Lara, actually, it's funny we mentioned Civilization. She has gotten on the Civilization thing lately. Because they have. There's a simulator. It's like an expansion or something for Xbox. And so she's all over that. And, you know, but at the same time, so I'm playing this game on my iPhone lately, which I just. And I rue the day that I ever bought it. I just so deeply regret purchasing the game. And I've heard from several other people who purchased it, people who heard me talk about it, like for the first 2 days that I had it, where I was like, this game is awesome. And so, you know, it's like hearing a guy who just took his first hit of smack, you know, and he goes, this is the best thing ever. You're a fool if you don't try it. I would strongly advise that you buy some heroin now and inject it into your body.
I can buy this at any bus station, anywhere.
Whereas you really should have waited to see how that purchase worked for him in the long term. But the deal with Zombie Gunship is that. That's what I'm saying.
Hello.
Yeah, but see. But see, that's how I sounded the first couple of days, and then later I was just like, I so deeply regret this decision. But the deal with Zombie Gunship is you can either get bigger and better and louder guns by shooting the requisite number of zombies. You get a certain amount of money per head, and then then you can go to the gun store and you can amp up. Or they handily enough give you the option, because it's on your iPhone, where they've already got all your goddamn purchase information, like, in the phone anyway, just like with Xbox. I mean, they've got your credit card information, like, right there. And because all the purchases are happening through the iPhone App Store. So they've already got all your stuff on file. So they just say, well, okay, if you want to shoot 75,000 more zombies, you'll be able to get this high-powered Gatling gun that's also a flamethrower.
Or
you could just give us $5. And you go, okay. Like, and, you know, just so, it's so unbelievably.
And the monkey gets fatter.
Exactly. Let's see. Let us switch to entertainment news, if you got some of that set aside.
Smurfly.
Here is your entertainment news for Friday, right here at Legion of News.
UFC fighter Jason Mayhem Miller was arrested last week for assault. After the fighter allegedly put his sister into a headlock and then refused to let her go. Law enforcement tells TMZ, Miller and his sis were at some party in North Carolina when his sister decided she just wanted to take off. According to law enforcement, Jason's sister claims he wouldn't let her leave and put her into a headlock. We're told that Jason's sisters managed to escape or tap out and notified the Chatham County Sheriff, who said Jason was arrested later that evening for simple assault and false imprisonment. Jason has since posted bail and has been released. Several calls to both Jason and his sister were not returned for some strange reason. Also, Danny DeVito gets his own star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. That's right. The Emmy-winning actor was honored Thursday with a star number 2,445 on the famous walkway. Really, do you think Danny deserves a full star, not maybe like an asterisk or possibly like a comma?
Also, I am to understand, I don't know if this is true, but this is the thing I've always heard, that the deal with the Hollywood Walk of Fame is that, I mean, we make a big deal of it, but I'm to understand that you can, essentially anybody can get one, you just have to fork over the money.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't even know how much it costs, but if you pay for it, like, they'll give you one.
Yeah. So, that was my understanding for the longest time, the days where it was like an award that you won, like an Academy Award or like you said, like an Emmy. Those are gone. That now there's just a price tag on it. I don't know if they need these spaces filled. And I mean, how far does it stretch? I mean, if 2,445 blocks, those are pretty big squares.
That's
too.
A good question, actually, because I've done, you know, like if you go down to that part of LA, you'll see, and it does stretch for and it's $25,000 apparently.
Yeah.
To get one of those, you know, and the thing is, Ed Wood has got one, and so now that Ed Wood has one, and I think Francis the Talking Mule actually has one too, it seems like we should just, like, it's our duty as a society to come up with, like, the least deserving actor we can possibly imagine. I wonder if Clint Howard has one. That's a guy that deserves.
Absolutely.
Okay, you know, what about Zeppo?
Zeppo Marx?
Yeah.
I would say, you know, as a group, the Marx Brothers, and then one for Harpo, like a lone one for Harpo. I don't know if I think, because I feel he's kind of worked outside of the realm, not just by himself.
Shemp.
No, absolutely not. Shemp does not get a square.
Really?
Yeah, no, absolutely
okay.
not.
All right.
Shemp is a poor man, poor, destitute man's Curly. So absolutely not.
All right.
He shouldn't even be allowed legs.
Okay.
He shouldn't be allowed to be able to look in that direction.
His bones should be dug up and hammered into dust.
The ceremony was held in connection with the September 13th release of the DVD of the sixth season of the FX comedy series, which is hilarious. It's Always Funny in Philadelphia, in which DeVito stars as the ne'er-do-well owner of a Philadelphia bar.
What show is this?
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Which I've never, and that's the thing where it's like, I've got the first four seasons sitting at home and I haven't watched any of them.
It is good. It is, it's a good, I'd say, junk food style show, because there's no linear plot that sort of runs through it. It's all
to get in the way.
Yeah, it's just like, you could jump in anywhere and with relative ease kind of follow the plot, but it's just very absurdist and very hilarious that I've felt. So yeah. As well, we have the Gerard Depardieu incident is finally explaining why he peed on the floor of an Air France plane this week, blaming the whole thing on prostate issues, but insisting he offered to clean up the mess. See, that's the kind of gentleman Gerard Depardieu is. Gerard's traveling companion on the flight, Edward Bauer, has released a statement on Depardieu's behalf, saying that Girard has prostate problems and is very worried about humiliating himself. Bear claims he gave Girard a bottle to pee in while the two were on the plane, but the bottle quickly overflowed. And then the flight attendant refused to let the actor use the lavatory.
Okay,
this explanation is really not helping whatsoever.
I mean, and you know, if you're not wanting to embarrass yourself, it seems like saying that you got a prostate the size of a bagel is probably not the first thing you want to come out with in terms of a public explanation for something. I mean, it would be less embarrassing if he was just like. If he just said, like, I was rip-roaring drunk because I'm rich and famous and I was up all night banging starlets, you know, and
okay, Gerard.
And so, you know, sometimes you just got to go. There you go.
As this opposed, is like his, Gerard, he's got a leaky goiter, and then the goiter rag that we had tied around it wasn't sufficient, it began to leak, and then they wouldn't let us use the lavatory.
But, I mean, even if you had a prostate issue, and I understand that the deal is that as, you know, as men age, and I am not at this age yet, thankfully, but apparently it looms on the horizon for everyone, like a large bladder pressing sun, that
one day threatens to encompass us all.
Your prostate enlarges, presses down in your bladder, and then et cetera, which is why you get the old guys who are like, have to get up. Do you have problems with intermittent stream or whatever they say to guys? but it's like, I don't understand how that then results in you. See, now I have to go to the bathroom. I don't understand how that results. In, like, you, quote, overfilling the jar that you have with you or whatever. And also, it's not like your prostate just enlarges overnight. Like, it's not like your prostate is fine, and then the next day it's just the size of the Goodyear blimp.
Someone angers your prostate, and its eyes change color, and suddenly it's like you've got jaundice, but, like, only on one side, and it's bulging.
So it seems like you'd be aware that was... And if you're Gerard Depardieu, you're having to fly a lot. You're traveling, to promote your films and whatever. So it seems like he would be aware that, like, you know, bring a wineskin or something maybe with you. Or just...
sheep bladder.
Or
something.
I mean, it's, to bring the proper amount of urine storage material.
Sir, your box of pickle jars will not fit in the overhead compartment. We're going to have to check this. No, I am Gerard Depardieu. You do not understand. My prostate, you will not make it when he is angry. The worst French accent. This is more offensive than slavery.
Okay.
Moving on, David Beckham got pulled over in Malibu yesterday after cops decided he was too shady for his own good. Law enforcement sources tell TMZ, which apparently is everywhere, the L.A. County Sheriff's Department stopped Beckham's SUV on Pacific Coast Highway because the window tint on the vehicle was just too damn dark. But fear not, Galaxy fans were told that Beckham was merely given a warning and sent about his way. Tinting fun fact, the winner of RuPaul's Drag Race was arrested for weed possession in Georgia this week after cops stopped the car he was riding in for illegal window tint. So you know, it's any excuse to pull you over with the window tint, and these kids these days with their long hair and their yeah music and their window tinting.
Okay. We got 1 minute and 10 seconds, Jim Willig.
Oh, okay. So then I will simply flounder about looking. Well, no, there's another story here that I had.
Somebody's asking if we're going to play the Anderson Cooper. Have you heard this, the Anderson Cooper thing?
The giggle?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
It's disturbing. I do have the audio from it. I was going to play it next hour, but I have that set aside. Somebody, Don Geronimo, was playing it yesterday to hilarity ensued.
Yeah, I had recaled the Court and Fatboy story with something regarding... him when I was in high school, but I'll save that for the next hour.
I have no idea what you just said or what it means. That was just gibberish.
What you said in no way addressed the question, Brent, and we are
that
all
was just like a
friend.
Series of words that you made by chopping up all of the sentences you said this hour and throwing them in the air and then randomly assembling the pieces in your head to a brand new sentence.
I'm not a public speaker, Rick Emerson. This is not my job.
You are a public speaker.
I am not. I'm not a good one.
Well, okay. On that, we can all agree. And, hey, guess what? That's magically done. And with that, we bring down the curtain on another exciting episode of Legion of News.
Seamless.
We come to you live each and every weekday. The studios of the Emerson News Network looming high over the milkpacking district here in glorious southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk today, Mr. Big Jim Willigan for Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provider Mr. Thomas Gill, executive producer Bruce Agler, chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show is next hour at rickemersonshow.com, where today we have a taser watch coming up, also penis watch coming up, monkey watch. We'll have the Anderson Cooper sound, more on the West Memphis 3 being released, and all that. Don't forget, you can get this program as a direct MP3 download here at Cascadia.fm or at legionofnews.com or via iTunes if you like. And we'll see you next hour at rickemersonshow.com or for mobile listeners, mobile.rickemerson.com. Thank you for listening. Have a safe and satisfying Friday. We will see you on Monday. Good day to you, sir.